Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder. I'll be your guide today as we go through Chapter 6 of The Murder of Little Mary Fagin. Before we get into that, and Chapter 6 is a fairly short chapter compared to the two we've just had, 4 and 5, that have long sections from the trial testimony. Chapter 6 is sentencing and aftermath. So we've heard the prosecution's case, we've heard the defense case, and now we're going to hear about what happened. I believe it leads up to and through the lynching. And before we get going, I wanted to give you a basic picture of this Jew denied that he knew Mary Fagin. But the reality is, this Jew is doing the accounts ledgers in one thing, and Mary Fagin is working in the factory portion that's directly opposite him. And also, the men's bathroom is basically right next to where she's working. And this is an odd fact. Leo Frank was known for drinking copious amounts of black coffee. So he says he didn't know her. The reality is he would have walked by her a minimum of hundreds of times. This is how dishonest Jews are. And I have an article that someone showed me, which is about a Jew who wrote a PhD essay dissertation in 1968, in which it's a complete tissue of lies. In fact, this guy is sort of the perfect Jew in terms of being an out-and-out liar, Leonard Dinnerstein, simply inventing stuff. This is the thing that non-Jews have a particularly hard time grasping about Jews. In fact, Hitler goes into it in Mein Kampf. He says, little people can imagine people lying about little things because they do some of that themselves. But they can't imagine people lying about big stuff, the Holocaust being the prime example. And that's where the Jewish tradition of brazen lying, they will lie about literally anything. The Holocaust is the most famous example, and it was updated in 9/11, which was a Mossad production. And as we pointed out other times, or I've mentioned other times, the Jews lie about big lying. Hitler and Goebbels are quoted by, in some of these false manufactured graphics the Jews create for the dolt conservative base of the demographic period on the right to circulate. Jews claim that Hitler and Goebbels advocated big lying, when in fact Goebbels and Hitler were describing a Jewish technique. So they're brazen enough to lie about lying. It doesn't get any more Jewish than lying about lying. But I'll include this Leonard Dinnerstein. I may even read the article sometime because it's really remarkable and it's really telling. What Jews do is make up lies. They write articles based on these lies. They write PhD theses based on these lies. And then these same Jews are quoted by other Jews. And remember what David Irving says, most people don't do any original research. So all these people who are called historians, and remember, Irving has no formal training. Most people who are called historians are simply read a bunch of secondhand material and then write their own piece that's based on all these other secondhand reports. They don't actually go out and talk to the people and get in the archives like Irving, for one, does, and really find out, wie es eigentlich gewesen, as von Ranke, famous historian, said, how it actually was. So, it ain't what you know, it's what you know that just ain't so. And then you couple the Jewish control of the mass media, and they're able to successfully pull off the hoax of presenting their falsified, but apparently objectively, externally valid, credentialed, scholarly work, which is nothing but a veneer on a bunch of politically interested anti-white lies that they're spreading. And Dinnerstein is a perfect example of this, coming along years after the fact and promoting just a whole set of fallacies and overt lies about what happened in the Frank case. And he is spreading the idea that they were claiming, that the crowds gathered outside this trial and basically scared the people into convicting Leo Frank. Utter, utter, utter lies. And so characteristic in his looks and his actions is this Leonard Dinnerstein, that he really is an emblematic and representative Jew. Anyway, we'll go into that more later, but the point here is that Leo Frank denies he knows Mary Fagin. Well, he has his damn off. You can see the picture. He's sitting there. He's hearing and looking into the factory. He can see this girl. He's got to walk by her to go to the bathroom. He knows who she is. He's talked to her multiple times. He's seen her thousands of times. He's walked within a couple feet of her many, many, many times. So if Jew, then liar is what I say. If Jew, then lie. They lie. It was what we did. It was what you do. It's how you get through life. That's what Monica Lewinsky said. She was from a family of rich Jews. They're basically hustlers and brazen liars. And they admit it. You don't have to read very far into their material to find them admitting what they actually do. All right, and with that prolegomenon, preface, related supplemental material, let's head into Mary Fagan's name for the victim. Great niece of the victim. Let's head into her chapter 6, Sentencing and Aftermath. Now she says, because Judge Roan feared a public uprising against Leo Frank, he secretly brought Frank and the other principals together in the courtroom for the formal sentencing. The sentence read, whereupon it is considered, ordered, and adjudged by the court that the defendant Leo M. Frank be taken from the bar of this court to the common jail of the county of Fulton, and that he be safely there kept until his final execution in the manner fixed by law. It is further ordered and adjudged by the court that on the 10th day of October, 1913, and remember the crime happened April 26, 1913, the trial is then in July, three months later, and now he's saying it is further ordered and adjudged that on the 10th day of October, 1913, the defendant Leo Frank shall be executed. So they have today it would take a minimum of 10 years due to legally guaranteed appeals in most states. And I think the average is probably like 25 years. I suspect. I seem to recall that figure. But anyway, here they had it all wrapped up in 6 months. So they're ordering his execution the day of October, 10th day of October 1913. The defendant, Leo M. Frank, shall be executed by the sheriff of Fulton County in private, witnessed only by the executing officer, a sufficient guard, the relatives of such defendant, and such clergymen and friends as he may desire, such execution to take place in the common jail of Fulton County, and that said defendant on that day, between the hours of 10 o'clock a.m. and 2 o'clock p.m., be by the sheriff of Fulton County hanged by the neck until he shall be dead, and may God have mercy in his soul. That's some old school sharking right there. In open court, this 26th day of April, 1913, Frank addressed the court. Your Honor, I say now, as I have always said, I am innocent. Further than this, my case is in the hands of my counsel. The trial of Leo Frank had been the longest and most expensive trial in Georgia history at that time. Longest and most expensive. The stenographic record itself was 1,080,060 words. The state star witness, Jim Conley, had been on the witness stand longer than any other witness in state history, and it was the first time that a black man's testimony helped to convict a white man, a Jew. Upon its conclusion, Rosser and Arnold, the attorneys for Frank, said, we deem it not amiss to make a short statement as the attorneys of Leo M. Frank to the public. The trial which has just occurred and which has resulted in Mr. Frank's conviction was a farce, and not in any way a trial. In saying this, we do not make the least criticism of Judge Roan, who presided. Judge Roan is one of the best men in Georgia, and is an able and conscientious judge. Parentheses, Judge Roan was Rosser's senior law partner from 1883 to 1886. Now, you got a limited legal community here in Atlanta, and comparatively small population. Quote, the temper of the public mind was such that it invaded the courtroom and invaded the streets and made itself manifest at every turn the jury made, and it was as impossible for this jury to escape the effects of this public feeling as if they had been turned loose and been permitted to mingle with the people. In doing this, we are making no criticism of the jury. They were only men, and unconsciously this prejudice rendered any other verdict impossible. It would have required a jury of Stoics, a jury of Spartans, to have withstood this situation. The time ought to come when this man will get a fair trial, and we profoundly believe that it will. The final judgment of the American people is a fair one. It is sometimes delayed in coming, but it comes. We entered into this case with a profound conviction of Mr. Frank's innocence. The result has not changed our opinion. Every step of the trial has intensified and fortified our profound conviction of his innocence. A series of appellate moves followed. One's reminded of Rodney Dangerfield handing the ref a 50 and, keep it fair, keep it fair. You know, they're thinking, they're setting the grounds for claiming, you know, crap like Dinnerstein would claim 50 years later. Even though there were three papers that were reporting on this, basically word by word, as is my understanding, and nowhere did any of these papers say anything about undue influence. This is all completely made up by the Jews after the fact to go along with their stereotypes of Jews as holy, innocent, noble victims beset by an evil anti-Semitic white man, but particularly Southern white man. And, you know, Jews are the ones who always have blood libel on their lips, but they are the ones who practice blood libel here against the South. And then later this, they would say the same stuff about Nazi Germany. Always the opposite of what the Jew says is the truth, unless it serves the Jew in the moment to tell something that isn't a lie. Anyway, so they're setting the groundwork for all their appeals by suggesting prejudice, without trying to blame the people they have to work with going forward, like the judge. Frank's lawyers began to prepare their appeal immediately after the sentencing. 103 points were covered in this appeal, including affidavits about the alleged prejudice toward Leo Frank of two members of the jury, A.H. Henslee, H-E-N-S-L-E-E, and M. Johenning, J-O-H-E-N-N-I-N-G, maybe Swedish, German. They are going to break that Jew's neck, Hensley was quoted as saying to Dr. W.L. Ricker, R-I-C-K-E-R, who later swore an affidavit filed with Judge Roan prior to the trial. Quote, he stated that Frank was guilty of murder, Ricker's testimony concluded. The family of H.C. Lovenhard, L-O-V-E-N-H-A-R-D, swore that on meeting Marcellus Johenning on the street before the trial, he had told them, I know he is guilty. Other points raised included the jurors being influenced by the crowd's demonstrations outside the courtroom, that Conley's allegation of Frank's immoral activities should not have been allowed into evidence, and that the evidence did not support the verdict. Solicitor General Dorsey argued that the trial had been fair and countered with affidavits from 11 jurors who swore they did not hear or see demonstrations from crowds outside the courtroom and had reached their decision solely because of the weight of the evidence. Both jurors, who had been deemed prejudiced by the defense, denied the charges. Rosser and Arnold made a final plea to Judge Roan. Arnold said, it is the most horrible persecution of a Jew since the death of Christ. I mean, is that not unbelievable? On October 31st, 1913, Halloween, Judge Roan denied the defense's motion for a new trial, but he commented, quote, I am not convinced of the guilt or innocence of the defendant, but I do not have to be convinced. The jury was convinced, and that was enough. End quote. The ruling was affirmed by the Georgia Supreme Court on February 17th, 1914. So we're getting about 10 months later. He's arrested in a couple days. He's tried in 3 months. He's sentenced to execution another couple months after that, but his lawyers file appeal. The ruling is first affirmed by the Georgia Supreme Court in February of the following year, 2 months before the April when the crime occurred. So all this is within 1 year. The ruling was affirmed by the Georgia Supreme Court on February 17th, 1914, by a unanimous decision. However, two judges, Beck and Fish, dissented on the question of admissibility of Jim Conley's testimony as to Frank's sexual perversion, but did not find the evidence in question sufficient to alter the guilty verdict. Not long after the Georgia Supreme Court decision, the Atlanta Journal reported that the state biologist who examined the body of Mary Fagan had concluded after microscopic analysis that the hair found on the lathe, which the prosecution had cited as a major factor in the case, was not Mary Fagan's. The biologist told Solicitor General Dorsey, who, when later confronted by the Journal's reporters, said, I did not depend on the biologist's testimony. Other witnesses in the case swore that the hair was that of Mary Fagan, and that sufficed to establish my point. Several prosecution witnesses retracted their original testimony. The first was Albert McKnight, who now said he hadn't seen Frank the day of the murder. Mrs. Nina Formby related that the police had filled her with liquor and unduly influenced her to invent the story that Frank had phoned her on the murder night asking for a room for himself and a girl. A third, George Epps Jr., a friend of Mary Fagan's, now said he and Mary had not had a conversation aboard the trolley she rode to the factory on the day of the murder. Other witnesses conveyed that they had invented or lied about evidence because of the pressure brought by police detectives and or Solicitor Dorsey. Later, many of these same people repudiated their retractions. So again, there's got to be some kind of pressure being supplied behind the scenes, because remember, the public is very anti-Leo Frank. They completely believe that he's guilty. So why would all these people be changing or retracting their stories unless they're paid to or someone got to them and threatened them? It doesn't make sense. In addition to repudiated testimony, the defense lawyers restudied every aspect of the Frank case. Henry Alexander, one of the defense team, made a study of the murder notes allegedly written by Conley at Frank's direction. Since these were written on old carbon pads, Alexander studied the dateline, which read 190- like 1900 and whatever. He concluded that the pads were at least 4 years old. They had been placed in the basement in 1912, along with the records of H.F. Becker, the master of machinery who signed them and was no longer employed by the company. Mr. Alexander also alleged in a pamphlet that the words "night witch" in the note beside Mary Fagan's body, which had been interpreted to mean night watch or watchman by those who believed the notes had been written under the direction of a white man, actually referred to a Negro folktale, quote, "When the children cry out in their sleep at night, it means that the night witches are riding them, and if you don't go and wake them up, they will be found the next morning strangled to death with a cord around their necks," unquote. However, at the time the notes were discovered and read in the factory basement early in the morning of April 27th, when the detectives read the words "night witch," N-I-G-T, W-I-T-C-H, on two separate occasions, Newt Lee brightly volunteered, "That's me." In addition, when Conley was directed to write "night watchman," in quotes, by police during his interrogation, he promptly wrote down "night witch," spelling it the same misspelling, N-I-G-T, and "witch," reciting that that was his nickname for the night watchman whom Conley had never met, and thus could not know that he was in fact a tall, slim, black Negro. On March 7th, 1914, Frank was resentenced to die. So a month after the Georgia upheld the decision, a couple weeks later, or in the next month, he's resentenced to die since his appeal failed. The scheduled date was April 17th, 1914, so 10 days before the anniversary of the murder. The day before he was to hang, a stay of execution was obtained on an extraordinary motion for a new trial, which was based on newly found evidence. Three witnesses said the state star witness, Jim Conley, the black floor sweeper, was the killer. They were Conley's ex-girlfriend, a federal prisoner, and Conley's own lawyer. The celebrated private detective William Burns got an affidavit from Annie Maud Carter in New Orleans, M-A-U-D. Annie Maud Carter in New Orleans. This affidavit stated that Jim Conley told her he had called Mary Fagan over as she left Frank's office with her pay envelope, hit her over the head, and pushed her over a scuttle hole in the back of the building. Annie Maud Carter also said Conley told her he wrote the notes found by the body of Mary Fagan to put the suspicion on Newt Lee, the night watchman. She gave the Burns Agency some love letters from Conley, which the Constitution said were, quote, "so vile and vulgar they couldn't be published in the newspaper." The defense contended these love letters showed that Conley had, quote, "perverted passion and lust," close quote. Among the lines pointed to by the defense as evidence of Conley's perversion were, block quote, "give your heart to God, baby, and your ass to me. Now, baby, if you don't get out on no bond, or if you do get out on bond, you have that right hip for me, because if you hold your fat ass on the bottom and make Papa go like a kitty cat, then you've won a good man. That's me. I would try to give you this world, but if you let Papa put his long, ugly dick up your fat ass and play on your right and left hip just like a monkey playing on a trapeze, then Honey Papa will be dumb played hell with you." Solicitor General Dorsey returned Annie Maud Carter to Atlanta and put her in jail. Several days later, she refuted the affidavit given to the Burns Agency and said that her whole story was a lie. However, it was later alleged that Conley had definitely written the letters. A black prisoner named Freeman told his story to the prison doctor, who reported that Conley was the killer. Freeman said he and Conley were playing cards in the basement of the pencil factory and that Conley left to go up to the ladder to the main floor. Freeman said he heard some muffled screams, saw Conley wrestling someone, and became so scared that he fled. He later claimed that he saw Conley with a mesh bag containing the amount of Mary Fagan's pay, $120. Conley's court-appointed attorney, William Smith, thought Frank was innocent and made a public statement on October 2, 1914, saying so. He said that Conley's testimony was, quote, a cunning fabrication, unquote, and thought Conley himself was probably the murderer. This extraordinary revelation, which went against the lawyer-client confidentiality privilege, was extolled by those who believed in Frank's innocence and castigated as being caused by bribery by those who believed him guilty. So Conley's own lawyer is turning coat. Now, why would he do that? I mean, that would affect his professional reputation, you would certainly think. There must be some powerful inducement to do that. What do you think it would be? Smith revealed no new facts to support his beliefs, but instead tried to show how the already known facts had been misinterpreted because of Conley's lies. It has been said that Jim Conley confessed to William Smith, and a confession statement, allegedly by Conley, has been published in, for one, Confessions of a Criminal Lawyer by Alan Lumpkin Henson, as it sounds, who worked in the Georgia Attorney General's office at the time of the Leo Frank trial. Again, it has been said that Jim Conley confessed to William Smith, that his own lawyer, and a confession allegedly by Conley published in Confessions of a Criminal Lawyer by Alan Lumpkin Henson, who worked in the Attorney General's office in Georgia at the time of the trial. The chapter of Henson's book dedicated to the Frank case contains a third-hand or perhaps fourth-hand account of Conley's supposed confession. However, Walter Smith, William Smith's son, in an article by Bob Montgomery for the Atlanta Journal in 1932 about Smith's father, denied the authenticity of Conley's confession, quote-unquote in confession, but brought to light facts which had been previously undisclosed regarding William Smith's relationship to his client. William Smith was reputed to be a very conscientious and ethical lawyer. His prime obligation was to his client. If he was charged to defend a man, he did his best to do so, and he did so in the case of Jim Conley. Smith had been appointed to defend Conley by the court, and he worked very closely with the prosecutor, Hugh Dorsey. From the beginning, Smith believed in Frank's guilt, as did just about everyone else. Before Jim Conley went on trial, Smith visited him in his cell and coached him on how to react in the courtroom when he was cross-examined by Frank's defense. Smith acted out the style and gyrations of Luther Rosser to Conley so well that when the actual trial was in session and Rosser began yelling at Conley and shaking his fist in Conley's face, Conley was not rattled in the least, but, on the contrary, seemed amused. Smith went to great lengths to defend Conley and to dig up facts against Frank. So it's like quarterback in the practice team pretending to be a unique sort of quarterback that you're going to face in the coming game, and I guess he did a really good job of it. At some point in the course of the trial, Smith began to doubt that his client, say he did a very good job, he's a good lawyer, he coached him properly so that he would know what to expect, and indeed he got what he expected. And so one of the best lawyers in the South couldn't rattle this stupid, drunken, lying nigger, as he called him. At some point in the course of the trial, Smith began to doubt that his client had been telling the truth. Because he had an obligation to defend Conley, Smith tried to get him the lightest sentence possible. Conley was convicted as an accessory to the fact and sentenced to 1 year on the chain gang. Smith, having fulfilled his obligation to his client and remembering the double jeopardy clause, which assured him that Conley could never be tried for the same crime again, felt morally and legally free to do some investigating and probing on his own. He increasingly felt that Frank was innocent and that he himself was much responsible for Frank's conviction, and he tried to convince others of Frank's innocence. He felt that he had the blood of an innocent man on his hands. He launched a thorough investigation, which totally convinced him that Frank was innocent and that Conley was guilty. Smith went to Governor Slayton with his conclusions, and it is quite probable that Smith's story was important in helping Slayton reach the decision to commute Frank's sentence. Smith's conclusions were not made public for some time, but when they were, he was not very popular. Public opinion went against Smith and his family. William Smith carried a gun for protection when he walked the streets of Atlanta. Smith's life was threatened in so many ways that he and his family were forced to leave Georgia, not to return for many years. He gave up criminal law completely and for many years worked in a shipyard in New York as a detective for the Burns Agency. Many years later, he practiced civil law. Now, Burns was one of the more famous detectives in the U.S., and the Jews paid him a bunch of money to come down and spread red herrings in Atlanta to try to absolve Leo Frank. In the last years of his life, Smith's vocal cords were paralyzed and he could not speak. He carried a pad of paper on which to write messages. In the hospital room just before he died, William Smith was very weak, but he picked up a pad and scrawled the following letters. In articles of death, I believe in the innocence and good character of Leo M. Frank. None of this evidence was considered by the Supreme Court because in 1906, a constitutional amendment had been passed that the only grounds for reversal of verdicts in the higher court of Georgia were errors of law. There's a law, not interpretation, but the law, you misapplied the law or applied the wrong law. Ruling that new evidence was not an indication of procedural errors, on May 8, 1914, Superior Court Judge Ben H. Hill denied the defense motion for a new trial. This denial was affirmed unanimously on October 14, 1914, by the Georgia Supreme Court. Even before Leo Frank's trial had ended, certain Jewish organizations and groups raised the issue of religious prejudice. Appeals for funds for Frank's defense were made through mailing circulars and newspaper advertisements throughout the country, and particularly in the North. This aggravated the already strong feelings against Frank in Atlanta, and it resulted in a virtual reenactment of the Civil War between Northern and Southern newspapers, which increased in intensity as the trial progressed. At Frank's conviction and death sentence, virtually every Northern newspaper proclaimed a travesty of justice. Detectives and well-known attorneys were sent to Atlanta by some of the Northern newspapers to, quote, review and investigate, unquote, the case. Many concluded that Leo Frank was innocent, that the trial had been no trial at all. The New York Times became interested in the case, but they were admonished to print nothing, quote, which would arouse the sensitiveness of the Southern people and cause the feeling that the North is criticizing the courts of the people of Georgia, unquote. The New York Times and Collier's Weekly called for a new trial. Mass rallies were held in the United States cities and in London, Paris, and Frankfurt, calling for Frank's life to be spared. Thousands of letters, petitions, and telegrams were sent to Governor Slayton and soon-to-be Governor Nat Harris. However, the vitriolic exchanges between the Northern and Southern press helped to make the conviction of Frank an article of faith for Southerners. At the same time, the belief in Frank's innocence became the litmus test in the Jewish community of Atlanta for anti-Semitism. Again, what's the word for Jews who hate non-Jews? Anti-gentilism? Laxism, as I've suggested? They're anti-white, but they're also just anti-Goyim. They're anti-Gentiles. They hate everyone who's not a Jew. But there's no word for that hate that's commonly used. So if you use anti-Semitism, you're perfectly respectable. You use something that's known, and as people judge by labels, if you use laxism, or you're using something that's not known, or anti-gentilism is something that's not commonly known. So how respectable can it be if no one else uses it? So I don't have anything inside me. I just go by the way other people act, because I'm a schoolfish, like the vast majority of people. I judge by externals. I judge by labels. I can't do any better than that biologically. I'm a herd animal, and that's what humans basically are. And it's up to those of us, the minority, who are not, to be doubly hard in prosecuting our verbal war against the people who declared genocidal war on us. Fight back. Don't use their terms. Use your terms. Make them sweat and suffer under your labels. Deny their lying, dishonest labels, which are prejudicially loaded and contain logical fallacies. It's a war. On March 10th, 1914, so that's 11 months after this happened, the murder, the Atlanta Journal editorially called for a new trial. The journal piece was titled, "Frank Should Have a New Trial." And it said, block quote from this Atlanta Journal, "The journal cares absolutely nothing for Frank or for those who were engaged in his defense or prosecution. If Frank is found guilty after a fair trial, he ought to be hanged and his case should be made a horrible example to those who would destroy human life for generations to come. Leo Frank has not had a fair trial. He has not been fairly convicted, and his death without a fair trial and legal conviction will amount to judicial murder. We say this with a full understanding of the import of our words and the responsibility that rests upon us in making this appeal. We did so not in disrespect for the court or the lawyers or the jury. They did the best they could with the lights before them. We honor them for faithfully performing a most unpleasant duty as they saw it." See now, Eleanor, how can they possibly say that if this was the longest and most expensive trial in Georgia state history, and they're saying the judges and the jury are honest men who did the best they could, then what the hell are they talking about? All they can be saying is they reached the wrong decision because why? They're just saying they don't have any actual evidence or any basis for saying that he didn't receive a fair trial or should get a new trial. It proceeded precisely according to law. They just don't like the outcome. And they don't want to admit that they want to get this Jew off because he's a Jew. And if they're not Jews and they want him to get off, they want that because they're serving the Jews or they're afraid of the Jews. Continuing to quote the paper, again, the Atlanta Journal. "But this we do say without qualification. It was not within the power of human judges and human lawyers and human jurymen to decide impartially and without fear the guilt or innocence of an accused man under the circumstances that surrounded the trial." So again, it, just as we've seen within the last year in Ferguson and a couple years ago with Trayvon Martin, the controlled media, the anti-white Jew-controlled junk media, create a myth about the circumstances in this case that we're talking about of a trial 100 years ago, or the conditions in which, you know, some black criminal, objectively black criminal, was shot. And they call him an unarmed black teenager when he was objectively a black criminal. You see, so the power of the media to create myths, and these myths can go both ways, from the media into academia, from academia into media. But they're always pushing the same anti-white agenda. They're always pushing the same direction for the same reason. Long train of usurpations and abuses with always pursuing the same end was more or less, to paraphrase what Thomas Jefferson wrote about Great Britain and the reason we needed to break away from it. And so it is with the white race needing to break away from Jews. Continuing to quote the paper, "The very atmosphere of the courtroom was charged with an electric current of indignation which flashed and scintillated before the very eyes of the jury. The courtroom and streets were filled with an angry, determined crowd, ready to seize the defendant if the jury had not found him guilty. When the jury returned the guilty verdict, Frank was not in the courtroom. He was at the Fulton Tower. Cheers for the prosecuting counsel were irrepressible in the courtroom throughout the trial, and on the streets, unseemly demonstrations in condemnation of Frank were heard by the judge and jury. The judge was powerless to prevent these outbursts in the courtroom, and the police were unable to control the crowd outside. So great was the danger that the 5th Regiment of the National Guard was kept under arms throughout a great part of the night, ready to rush on a moment's warning to the protection of the defendant. The press of the city united in an earnest request to the presiding judge to not permit the verdict of the jury to be received on Saturday, as it was known that a verdict of acquittal would cause a riot such as would shock the country and cause Atlanta's streets to run with innocent blood. Under such indescribable conditions as these, Frank was tried and convicted. Was it a fair trial under these circumstances? Was a fair trial under these circumstances possible? So that this is the prejudicial way they describe whites looking out for one of their own and concerned that justice. And today, whites are indifferent and just sit back while blacks rape and Jews lie in the media and cover it up. You see? But when they were civically involved, when they saw that justice was done to their own, who was innocently killed, look at the way Jews come together to defend one of their own who's a pedophile, rapist, murderer, and serial molester of girls. And they object when whites legitimately defend their own. Oh, our man needs a new trial. He was tried unfairly. Continuing to quote the paper, the evidence on which he was convicted is not clear. The evidence was circumstantial, but on the strong side. Suppose he is hanged and it should develop that the man was innocent, as he claims. The people of this state would stand before the world convicted of murdering an innocent man by refusing to give him an impartial trial. Such a horrible thing is unthinkable. And yet it is possible, yea, an absolute certainty, that we are going to do that very thing unless the courts interfere. Ought Frank to have a new trial? The question carries its own answer. Let justice be done, though the heavens fall. That's the end of that quote. Now Mary Fagan again picks up. The outburst in the courtroom that the police were unable to control the crowds outside were events that all three newspapers had not printed during the trial. The outburst in the courtroom and that the police were unable to control the crowds outside were events that all three newspapers had not printed during the trial. So again, they're making up a myth after the fact. They're creating circumstances that did not exist in order to justify something that is illegal. And with their chutzpah, and they're proclaiming this in the name of justice and legality, that what they want needs to happen. The Journal remained quiet about these events for a year. The Atlanta Georgian, which was also silent during the trial, later called for a new trial. This sudden announcement by the Journal brought Tom Watson into the controversy. Watson had been, and where I post this at vnnforum.com, I've got the link to our reading of Watson's long article. He was a writer and a publisher, and he later went on to be, I always get it wrong, I think it was senator, as a result of his fine advocacy, but he had a paper in the Jeffersonian, and he had a magazine called Watson's, named after himself, and he wrote a very long article, and I did an audio tape of it, or I read it and commented as I'm doing here, but you can find that link where I post the link to all the chapters that we've done in this book, because it's highly relevant. Anyway, the sudden announcement by the Journal that they need a new trial brought Tom Watson into the controversy. Watson had been defeated for Vice President of the United States on the populist ticket in 1896, and afterwards devoted most of his time to writing history and editing his weekly newspaper, the Jeffersonian, and his monthly publication, Watson's Monthly Magazine. He immediately launched a scathing attack against those criticizing the results of the Frank case. Watson referred to Frank as being a, quote, Jew pervert, unquote. More of his vitriol was directed to Frank's being a member of and having access to wealth, thereby denying, he said, justice to the family of a poor factory girl. Again, they're portraying this rich Jew harassing a poor goy girl who has to work for a living. And the papers are portraying the Jew as the victim. More of his vitriol was directed to Frank's being a member of and having access to wealth, thereby denying, he said, justice to the family of a poor factory girl, a view shared by a substantial number of Georgia's population. In fact, an informal poll indicated that 4 out of 5 individuals believed in Frank's guilt. The fact that the Atlanta Journal was edited by Watson's political enemy, Hoke Smith, H-O-K-E, Smith, the South has a tradition of naming first names as last names. Family last names are used as first names. The fact that Atlanta Journal was edited by Watson's political enemy, Hoke Smith, did not endear its editorial opinions to Watson, and he claimed the paper's demand for a new trial was an effort by Smith, Hoke Smith, to drag the case into politics. Repeatedly, Watson asked the questions, Does a Jew expect extraordinary favors or immunities because of his race? And who is paying for all this? Watson described Mary Fagan as, quote, a daughter of the people, of the common clay, of the blouse and overall, of those who earn bread in the sweat of their face and who, in so many instances, are the chattel slaves of a sordid commercialism that has no milk of human kindness in its heart of stone. Close quote. Employment of Burns' detective agency by Frank supporters after the trial further inflamed Georgians. Burns offered a $1,000 reward to anyone who could provide evidence that Frank was a sexual pervert. No one came forward. The reward was increased to $5,000. No one came forward. Burns also brought forth evidence given to him by the Reverend C.B. Ragsdale, pastor of the Atlanta Baptist Church, who told the story of overhearing two black men, one of whom confessed to killing, quote, a little girl at the factory the other day, unquote. Later, Ragsdale repudiated his statement. A Burns operative, Mr. Toby, T-O-B-I-E, had earlier been retained by members of the Fagan family and their neighbors to investigate the murder and discover the murderer. After several weeks of investigating, Toby at length resigned from the matter but announced that he, like Scott of the Pinkerton Agency, the detectives of the Atlanta Police Department, and Dorsey's staff, had concluded that Frank was the guilty party. Dorsey alleged in court that Burns tried to bribe witnesses to give false testimony, and finally Burns' connection was dropped. So Jews pay goys to front for them so that they can obscure the fact that this is Jewish agency that's really at work. It's Jewish money is the motor of all this. And they hire a famous goy detective just like they'd hire a Bush or hire a Clinton to pursue their agenda, fooling the left or right. To go down there, oh, I'll give $5,000 to anyone who can prove Leo Frank is a sexual pervert. Now, how are you going to prove that? You see, and so to, as I said, draw red herrings to fool you that Frank is guilty. The hearing on extraordinary motion for a new trial was based on the absence of Frank at the reception of the verdict. This absence was agreed on by the defense, prosecutors, and Frank. Again, brazen. How brazen is that? This motion was denied on June 6, 1914, and the denial was affirmed unanimously by the Georgia Supreme Court on November 14, 1914. So he's already put off his execution by over a year. On December 7, 1914, a writ of error was taken to the United States Supreme Court and was denied. On December 9, 1914, Frank was sentenced to be hanged on January 22, 1915. So now we're getting on toward 20 months, you know, after the murder. Frank's attorneys then filed an application for a writ of habeas corpus to the United States Supreme Court. On April 19, 1915, this was dismissed by a 7-2 vote and was the last judicial avenue for Frank. The two justices who dissented were Oliver Wendell Holmes and Charles Evans Hughes. They dissented on the basis that a lower court hearing should have been held to determine the validity of the defense affidavits asserting mob pressure on the jury. They wrote, quote, "The single question in our minds is whether a petition alleging that the trial took place in the midst of a mob savagely and manifestly intent on a single result is shown on its face. This is not a matter for polite presumptions. We must look the facts in the face. Any judge who has sat with juries knows that in spite of forms, they are extremely likely to be impregnated by the environing atmosphere." Of course, we are speaking only of the case made by the petition and whether it ought to be heard. Upon allegations of this gravity, in our opinion, it ought to be heard, whatever the decision of the state court may have been. It may be that on hearing a different complexion, that on a hearing, a different complexion would be given to the judge's alleged request and expression of fear. But supposing the alleged facts to be true, we are of opinion that if they were before the Supreme Court of Georgia, it sanctioned a situation upon which the courts of the United States should act. And if for any reason they were not before the Supreme Court, it is our duty to act upon them now and to declare lynch law as little valid when practiced by a regularly drawn jury as when administered by one elected by a mob intent on death. The only hope, and that was a dissent, a minority dissent, so the majority didn't see it that way. And again, this is Mary Fagan trying to be very, very fair, bending over backwards to give the Frank case every chance to make itself. The only hope left for Frank was Governor John Slayton, since he's been rejected by the Georgia State Appeals Court and he's been ejected by the U.S. Supreme Court. The only hope left for Frank, on page 162 now, was Governor John Slayton. Frank's attorneys appealed to Slayton for a commutation of his sentence from hanging to life imprisonment. Slayton referred this request to the State Prison Commission and asked them to pass their recommendation to the governor. Meanwhile, Frank's attorneys filed an appeal for a clemency hearing before the three-man Georgia Prison Commission. The hearing date was scheduled for May 31st, 1915, 2 years and a month after the crime. On May 31st, 1915, that same date, out-of-state and in-state delegations appeared to plead for Frank's life. They asked that his life be spared in the name of Georgia's honor, decency, and God. They had submitted voluminous documents to convince the commission an error had been made. Included was a letter by Presiding Judge Leonard Roan, written shortly before his death on March 23, 1915. So these Jews are really pursuing every possible angle to get this Jew off, or to get whatever they can. And this is indicative of their unflagging energy in protecting and advancing their own interest and defending their own people, no matter what kind of foul crime they've committed. This is what makes them a tribe and makes them so dangerous to all other people. It's why they dominate other people. Relentless energy, relentless self-dealing, relentless dishonesty, relentless lack of morality. They simply are not Aryans, and they cannot be treated as individuals by our tribe. They are forcing us to evolve into a team to take them on because they are a team. And they've shown that as just a couple percentage of the population, they can dominate a population that's over 90% white because they work as a team. And so long as we pretend they're individuals or worry about our morality towards them, we haven't got a chance. They will continue to dominate us and allow their kind to rape and murder us. Tom Watson, so they included in their documentation on May 31st, they're trying to get him, they're still trying to save him there. And they even include a letter from Judge Leonard Roan, written shortly before he died. Tom Watson commented that Roan was, quote, out of his mind, unquote. Some members of Roan's family doubted the authenticity of the letter for years. They indicate that at the time the letter was written, Judge Roan's physical and mental state were critical. They also stated that one of Frank's lawyers went to the sanatorium, and it was at this time that the letter was written and signed by Roan. The family also felt that since Judge Roan refused Frank a new trial, the letter causes some questions. However, Roan's rational mental state was attested to by Dr. Wallace E. Brown, owner of the Berkshire Hills Sanatorium. I mean, these are the Jews going to the old folks' home and harassing this guy who's, you know, basically on the edge of dying and getting him to put forward a letter because, you know, the Jews are the assholes who want a certificate that claims they're really a rose. Anyway, the guy who's running the sanatorium, which the declining Leonard Roan is situated at this point, says, personally, Wallace E. Brown, the owner of the Berkshire Hills Sanatorium, personally appeared before the undersigned authority, Wallace E. Brown, who, being duly sworn, deposes and says on oath that he's the owner and proprietor of the Berkshire Hills Sanatorium, that he has been a resident of North Adams, Massachusetts, practically all his entire life, that he is now serving his third term as the mayor of the city of North Adams. Deponent says that on Sunday, November 29, 1914, Judge L.S. Roan of Atlanta, Georgia, dictated to Mrs. Wallace E. Brown, who is then Miss Jane Dady, D-A-D-I-E, a letter, a copy of which hereinafter follows. So, North Adams, Massachusetts, December 1914, to Rosser and Brandon and R.R. Arnold, attorneys for Leo M. Frank. Gentlemen, after considering your communication, asking that I recommend executive clemency in the punishment of Leo M. Frank, I wish to say that at the proper time I shall ask the prison commission to recommend and the governor to commute Frank's sentence to life imprisonment. This, however, I will not do until the defendant's application shall have been filed and the governor and prison commission shall have had opportunity to study the record in the case. It is possible that I showed undue deference to the opinion of the jury in this case when I allowed their verdict to stand. They said by their verdict that they had found the truth. I was still in a state of uncertainty and so expressed myself. My search for the truth, though diligent and earnest, had not been so successful. In the exercise of judicial discretion, restricted and limited, according to my interpretation of the decisions of the reviewing courts, I allowed the jury's verdict to remain undisturbed. I had no way of knowing it was erroneous. After many months of continued deliberation, I am still uncertain of Frank's guilt. This statement of uncertainty is largely due to the character of the Negro Conley's testimony by which the verdict was evidently reached. Therefore, I consider this a case in which the chief magistrate of the state should exert every effort in ascertaining the truth. The execution of any person whose guilt has not been satisfactorily proven to the constituted authorities is too horrible to contemplate. I do not believe that a person should meet with the extreme penalty of the law until the court, jury, and governor shall all have been satisfied of that person's guilt. Hence, at the proper time, I shall express and enlarge upon these views directly to the governor and prison commission. However, if for any cause I am prevented from doing this, you are at liberty to use this letter at the hearing. Very truly yours, L.S. Roan. Deponent, so the owner heard him sign this or saw him sign this. Deponent heard Judge Roan dictate the letter here and before copied and saw him read and sign same. Prior to the time Judge Roan dictated and signed said letter, he had stated to deponent that he was not convinced of Frank's guilt and that if executive clemency should ever be asked for Frank, he intended to recommend commutation. Deponent says that Judge Roan became a patient in a sanatorium on the 10th day of July 1914 and remained there as such until the 21st day of February 1915. During the entire time Judge Roan was a patient in said sanatorium, there was positively no doubt that Judge Roan was mentally responsible in every respect. Deponent is a practicing physician of 25 years, having graduated from Bellevue Hospital Medical College in New York City, and is now a resident of North Adams, Massachusetts. Signed, Wallace E. Brown. Subscribed and sworn to before me this 4th day of August 1915 at North Adams, Massachusetts. Signed, C.T. Phelps, Notary Public. So, sealed, authorized, notarized, all of this. Mary Fagan again, the author. No one had spoken against commutation of Frank's sentence. Finally, the defense's long, hard fight seemed won. But the next morning, some 50 determined-looking men from Cobb County, where Mary Fagan's family lived, marched into the prison commission office and demanded the hearing be reopened. See, this is how it works when whites actually defend themselves. And you have to understand that legal forms are just the human stylized version of animal bluffing and animal fighting. Ultimately, it all comes down to will and strength and the will of one group of creatures to defend itself against another group. And the legal machinery or the democratic machinery is just the way that we humans do it. But what's going on is a biological struggle to see who's stronger. You understand that? That's the reality. The reality is not what you hear in Sunday school. It's not what you read in the papers. It's what I just said. If you're willing to kill and die, then you have a chance. And if you're not, those who are willing to kill and die will take what you have from you. Don't blame me. I didn't create this world. I'm not God. I'm not responsible for evolution. I'm only responsible for seeing things as clearly as I can and for my fidelity in reporting what I see to you, the person who is being educated here at Learning College. So 50 determined men, and remember, echoes of what Lenin said around this very time a few years later, if there had been 100 good men, they could have stopped us from effecting the communist revolution and murdering tens and tens and tens of millions of whites. this brazen lying majority, or tiny, pardon me, not majority, tiny, tiny little minority, but if it has guts on its side, it can dominate the herd. And that's what's happened. Guts, craft, cunning, deceit, whatever it takes to get on top. Nature has no rules. You'd say might is right, but you could also say cunning is right. Whatever wins is right. Right is right. If you achieve the power, then it's legitimate by nature's laws and nature's standards. If you want to adduce some adventitious god or invent him, that's on you. Nature says, look, buddy, rules are clear. 99.9% of the species that ever existed on Earth are extinct. Do you think I care if you join them? I care not one whit. All history shows that. So if you want to claim there's a God and justice and these things are all human inventions, but the reality is what I have to show you in my display case, and that is the bones of a lot of extinct creatures. It's reality, folks. If you have those determined men, you can achieve anything. If you don't have them, you'll suffer everything. But the next morning, some 50 determined-looking men from Cobb County, where Mary Fagan's family lived, marched into the prison commission office and demanded the hearing be reopened. They're like, yeah, it's not going to go down like that. It's going to go down like this, and y'all are going to deal with it and like it. Included in the group were former Governor Joseph M. Brown and Herbert Clay, solicitor of the Blue Ridge Circuit. So these are top-level men in Georgia. They had not sold out to the Jews. They were willing to stand up for justice for their own people. They were willing to defend their own kind rather than today be Lindsey Graham's and side with the Jews, truckle under before the Jews, and greedily lap up the emoluments that siding with the Jews always brings you. Punch-pulling to serve the Jews, as the conservative writers do. Back then, they were real men, and they would defend their own. They weren't afraid. They weren't weak like people today. Those that kind did exist, but they were not dominant as they are today. The good men were dominant back then, at least in the South. Included in the group of 50 determined men were former Governor Joseph M. Brown and Herbert Clay, solicitor of the Blue Ridge Council. So true elite, leading like a true elite should. Clay spoke for hours against commutation, arguing that Georgia would be dishonored for all time if Frank were spared for his alleged abominable crime. The newspapers reported that, quote, there was no doubting that they really believed with all their hearts that Frank was guilty. The commission reopened the hearing. The commissioners listened intently and said nothing. At the end of the reopening, they issued a statement that they would offer their recommendation to Governor Slayton in a week. By a 2-1 vote, on June 9, 1915, the commissioners refused to recommend a commutation to Governor Slayton. It was now up to the governor. So every single thing has gone against Leo Frank being let off. Every single thing. Except the force from the north and anyone they can bribe, cajole, whatever. Anyway, that is the end of Chapter 6, and we'll pick it up very soon with Chapter 7 and see how this tale eventuates. I want to thank you for being with me today. My name again is Alex Linder, and this is the Learning College / Vanguard Audiobooks, as we call it, and we do all kinds of stuff to give you a true perspective on white history and the white context in which we live and find our lives, and it's something you can't get from Jew-controlled TV. You can't get from Jew-controlled Academy. That is all the things they call colleges. So believing the truth is important. You need to know what's actually going on. That's why we're doing this and bringing it to you. And we'll leave it there for right now. That ends Chapter 6, and we'll be back with Chapter 7 real soon.